Now, I did find one tiny sort of interview with Cary Grant, and since I've spoken for him, I would like to play this for you. In 1985 and 1986, Cary Grant traveled around the country, and he did these little one-man shows in small towns where he would just sit on a stage for a couple of hours and talk about his life and his career, and he would take questions from the audience. And here, from 1986, from Davenport, Iowa, less than 3 minutes long, this is the only recording that I've ever heard of Cary Grant giving an interview, and he actually talks about his famous Judy, Judy, Judy phrase. So, this is very special.
Number three, we have a question up here.
Funny question.
I'm sorry. Number three.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Good evening, Mr. Grant.
Good evening.
Who is Judy, Judy, Judy?
As far as we know, we looked up track after track and outtakes after outtakes. I never said Judy, Judy, Judy. And we think it started with a fellow called Larry Storch, who finally became a pretty good actor in WWE. He did imitations in those days. And as far as we can make out, Larry Storch was greeting Judy Garland purportedly. He was working with another imitator called Franz Desmond, I think it was his name. And he said... doing me, he said, well, Judy, this is as far as we go. Well, I tell you what happens about that. There are many young ladies called Judy, as you know. And the moment a young man comes in front of me and says, I bet you don't know her name, I go right into it. I say, I bet it's Judy, Judy. I get him a dollar, and every time I get the dollar...
Mr. Grant, number two.
Well,
this side.
In charade, Audrey Hepburn says to you, you know what's wrong with you? Absolutely nothing. Now, I know that it's obvious every woman in this building feels this way, and this has made life very difficult for us men. Could you admit to one tiny flaw, like, don't you leave your dirty socks on the floor?
I'd like to introduce my wife to substantiate that fact. My wife is sitting there.
And I'm sorry, that's all there is. I wish there were more. I would...
Bye. This is the original 45 of Angel Baby by Rosie and the Originals.
Thank you.
This is the illusion of safety. It's called Always Somewhere Else. Experimental dance and pop, right?
street spinning. Yeah, your head will collapse, but there's nothing in it. You ask yourself, where is my mind? Where is my mind? Where is my mind?
Hiding me. Dance is an art in space and time. The object of the dancer is to obliterate that. The classical ballet, by maintaining the image of the Renaissance perspective in stage thought, kept a linear form of space. The modern American dance, stemming from German expressionism and the personal feelings of the various American pioneers, made space into a series of lumps, or often just static hills on the stage, with actually no relation to the larger space of the stage area, but simply forms that by their connection in time made a shape. Some of the space thought coming from the German dance opened the space out and left a momentary feeling of connection with it, but too often the space was not visible enough because the physical action was all of a lightness, like sky without earth or heaven without hell. The fortunate thing in dancing is that space and time cannot be disconnected, and everyone can see and understand that. A body still is taking up just as much space and time as a body moving. The result is that neither the one nor the other, moving or being still, is more or less important, except it's nice to see a dancer moving. But the moving becomes more clear if the space and time around the moving are one of its opposite, stillness. Aside from the personal skill and clarity of the individual dancer, there are certain things that make clear to a spectator what the dancer is doing. In the ballet, the various steps that lead to the larger movements or poses have, by usage and by their momentum, become common ground upon which the spectator can lead his eyes and his feelings into the resulting action. This also helps define the rhythm. In fact, more often than not, does define it. In the modern dance, the tendency or the wish has been to get rid of these unnecessary and balletic movements, at the same time wanting the same result in the size and vigor of the movement as the balletic action, and this has often left the dancer and the spectator slightly short. To quibble with that on the other side, one of the best discoveries the modern dance has made use of is the gravity of the body in weight. That is, as opposite from denying and thus affirming gravity by ascent into the air, the weight of the body in going with gravity down. The word heavy connotes something incorrect, since what is meant is not the heaviness of a bag of cement falling, although we've all been spectators of that too, but the heaviness of a living body falling with full intent of eventual rise. This is not a fetish or a use of heaviness as an accent against a predominantly light quality, but a thing in itself. By its nature, this kind of moving would make the space seem a series of unconnected spots, along with the lack of clear connecting movements in the modern dance. A prevalent feeling among many painters that lets them make a space in which anything can happen is a feeling dancers may have too. Imitating the way nature makes a space and puts lots of things in it, heavy and light, little and big, all unrelated yet each affecting all the others. About the formal methods of choreography, some due to the conviction that a communication of one order or another is necessary, others to the feeling that mind follows heart, that is, form follows content. Some due to the feeling that the musical form is the most logical to follow. The most curious to me is the general feeling in the modern dance that 19th century forms stemming from earlier pre-classical forms are the only formal actions advisable or even possible to take. This seems a flat contradiction of the modern dance, agreeing with the thought of discovering new or allegedly new movement for contemporary reasons, the using of psychology as a tremendous elastic base for content, and wishing to be expressive of the times, although how can one be expressive of anything else? but not feeling the need for a different basis upon which to put this expression, in fact being mainly content to indicate that either the old forms are good enough, or further, that the old forms are the only possible forms. These consist mainly of theme and variation and associated devices, repetition, inversion, development, and manipulation. There is also a tendency to imply a crisis to which one goes and then in some way retreats from. Now, I can't see that crisis any longer means a climax, unless we are willing to grant that every breath of wind has a climax, which I am. But then that obliterates climax being a surfeit of such. And since our lives, both by nature, by the newspapers, are so full of crisis that one is no longer aware of it, then it is clear that life goes on regardless, and further that each thing can be and is separate from each and every other, viz. The continuity of the newspaper headlines. Climax is for those who are swept by New Year's Eve. More freeing into space than the theme and manipulation holdup would be a formal structure based on time. Now, time can be an awful lot of bother with the ordinary pinch-penny counting that has to go on with it, but if one can think of the structure as a space of time in which anything can happen in any sequence of movement event and any length of stillness can take place, then the counting is an aid towards freedom rather than a discipline towards mechanization. A use of time structure also frees the music into space, making the connection between the dance and the music one of individual autonomy connected at structural points.
One philosopher asserted that he knew the whole secret. He surveyed the two celestial strangers from top to toe and maintained to their faces that their persons, their worlds, their suns and their stars were created solely for the use of man. At this assertion, our two travelers let themselves fall against each other, seized with a fit of inextinguishable laughter. That's from Voltaire's Micromegas in 1752. In the 17th century, there was still some hope that even if the Earth was not the center of the universe, it might be the only world. But Galileo's telescope revealed that, quote, the moon certainly does not possess a smooth and polished surface, close quote, and that other worlds might look just like the face of the Earth itself. The moon and the planets showed unmistakably that they had as much claim to being worlds as the Earth does, with mountains, craters, atmospheres, polar ice caps, clouds, and, in the case of Saturn, a dazzling, unheard-of set of circumferential rings. After millennia of philosophical debate, the issue was settled decisively in favor of what was called the plurality of worlds. They might be profoundly different from our planet. None of them might be as congenial for life, but the Earth was hardly the only one. This was the next in the series of great demotions, downlifting experiences, demonstrations of our apparent insignificance, wounds that science has, in its search for Galileo's facts, delivered to human pride. Well, some hoped, even if the Earth isn't at the center of the universe, the Sun is. The Sun is our Sun. So the Earth is approximately at the center of the universe. Perhaps some of our pride could in this way be salvaged. But by the 19th century, observational astronomy had made it clear that the Sun is but one lonely star in a great self-gravitating assemblage of suns called the Milky Way galaxy. Far from being at the center of the galaxy, our Sun, with its entourage of dim and tiny planets, lies in an undistinguished sector of an obscure spiral arm. We are 30,000 light years from the center. Well, our Milky Way is the only galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is in fact one of billions, perhaps hundreds of billions, of galaxies notable neither in mass nor in brightness, nor in how its stars are configured and arrayed. Some modern deep sky photographs show more galaxies beyond the Milky Way than stars within the Milky Way. Every one of them is an island universe containing perhaps 100 billion suns. Such an image is a profound sermon on humility. The long-standing view, as summarized by the philosopher Immanuel Kant, that without man, the whole of creation would be a mere wilderness, a thing in vain, and have no final end, is revealed to be self-indulgent folly. The principle of mediocrity seems to apply to all our circumstances. We would not have known beforehand that the evidence would be so repeatedly and thoroughly incompatible with the proposition that human beings are at center stage in the universe. But most of the debates have now been settled decisively in favor of a position that, however painful, can be encapsulated in a single sentence. We have not been given the lead in the cosmic drama. Perhaps someone else has. Perhaps no one else has. In either case, we have good reason for humility.
Rai Cooter and Ami Parkature and Diarabi.
There's nothing I can do.
You do know this is Yes, right? From Fragile, Heart of the Sunrise, right? Right. And somewhere over there is Circle doing a song called Matka.
Straight line moving and removing shoulders of the girl of sunshine. Straight line searching all the meanings of the song.
explain how you're pulling the cinnamon out of me. Well, I've been sitting here dead and the dog's saying pulling me.
Alone again, wondering where you have been. Your lonely voice calls across the starlit coast, reaching out to be seen. She cries your name three times again. She cries. She keeps crying out your name, but her scream sounds the same. How fickle fate can be. She cries your name three times again. She cries.
This, of course, is the wonderful Beth Orton. She cries your name. See, we're making one more turn, one more orbit. But we're coming back home.
Birds would scream for territory, can learn to sing you for her plea. Give a hand time on his reel. And there's a wasteland in your soul. The burnt out trees will leave you cold. Living out an ideal. She cries your name three times again. She cries your name. How long can this love remain? Cries your name 12 times again.
this is called The Carnival of Ecstasy, and it's the music that Jack Smith and Tony Conrad put together for the end of Jack's movie Flaming Creatures. I find it a celebration. It's about life, right?
And foragers. The frontier was everywhere. We were bounded only by the earth and the ocean and the sky. The open road still softly calls. Our little terraqueous globe is the madhouse of those hundred thousand millions of worlds. We who cannot even put our own planetary home in order, riven with rivalries and hatreds, are we to venture out into space? By the time we're ready to settle even the nearest other planetary systems, we will have changed. The simple passage of so many generations will have changed us. Necessity will have changed us. We're an adaptable species. It will not be we who reach Alpha Centauri and the other nearby stars. It will be a species very like us, but with more of our strengths and fewer of our weaknesses. More confident, far-seeing, capable, and prudent. For all our failings, despite our limitations and fallibilities, we humans are capable of greatness. What new wonders, undreamt of in our time, will we have wrought in another generation, and another? How far will our nomadic species have wandered by the end of the next century, and the next millennium? Our remote descendants, safely arrayed on many worlds through the solar system and beyond, will be unified. By their common heritage, by their regard for their home planet, and by the knowledge that whatever other life may be, the only humans in all the universe come from Earth. They will gaze up and strain to find the blue dot in their skies. They will marvel at how vulnerable the repository of all our potential once was, how perilous our infancy, how humble our beginnings, how many rivers we had to cross before we found our way.
That's why I'm stumbling down the
gates of steel. I should be rolling down the skyway on my cosmic wheels. Cosmic wheels. Cosmic wheels. Cosmic wheels. In the present position of the planet, it's impossible for me to say. Just when I find my course again, with these boulders in my way, I should be rolling down the skyway on my cosmic wheels. Instead of stumbling down this highway on my boots of steel. I should be rolling down the skyway on my cosmic wheels. Cosmic wheels. Cosmic wheels. Cosmic wheels. God is playing marbles with his planets and his stars, creating havoc through my life, through his influence on Mars. That's why I'm stumbling down the highway on my boots of steel. I should be rolling down the skyway on my cosmic wheels.
It's late. We've done a good full cycle this morning here on the Chill Room here on killradio.org. I'm DJ Bennett, and that was called Deep in the Cosmos. And I just wanted to tie space and time, dance, music, psychedelia, consciousness, and Carl Sagan Cosmos, and Pale Blue Dot. That last piece was from Pale Blue Dot. I wanted to tie them all together because they all work together. It all works together, don't you know? That's why it's cool. So you've been listening to The Chill Room tonight here on killradio.org. I've been trying this new kind of long format thing. Anyway, it's been fun tonight here on killradio.org, and I thank you for listening, you know, because it really is personal. It's, you know, it has to do with Noel Tamsit and Alan Keough and Dennis Wolfe and Louise Bialik and Michael Shepard and Jason and Sarah, and it goes and goes. And then there are the deep fans, eh? Anyway, that's the end of part one here on killradio.org.
We aren't completely done yet, though. So stay tuned.